This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
You're listening to KCBS In Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area's talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In Depth.
The news hit on the first day of August of the largest prisoner swap between the United States and Russia since the Cold War, a deal involving 24 people, including journalists, political dissidents, suspected spies, among others. And after months of negotiations with other European countries who released Russians in their custody as part of the exchange. Welcome to KCBS In Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. I'm joined this week by KCBS Radio's Mike DeWald. Mike, thanks for co-hosting In Depth with me.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
We're going to delve deeper into what may have been going on behind the scenes to make this prisoner swap happen, what this might mean for U.S. and Russia relations going forward, and if another trade of this magnitude could happen again. To help us with all of this, we're speaking with Larry Pfeiffer, former senior director of the White House Situation Room and chief of staff to the director of Central Intelligence Agency, Michael Hayden. Now he's the director of the Michael Hayden Center for Intelligence, Policy, and International Security. Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
Now, Larry, if we look at the way this swap went down, I would say it wasn't necessarily a surprise that a swap like this was possible, but the way it was announced, the way it was carried out, the immediacy of all that, did that timeline surprise you at all at how quickly it all came together and the Americans were back on American soil?
Well, from the public announcement to their arrival in the United States was a very short time, particularly when you look back at some other prisoner exchanges or prisoner releases, where some of them have gone to Germany for some recuperation before they come back to the United States. So that was a little unusual how quickly they got them back on U.S. soil. But in terms of the timeline to get these individuals back to the United States, I mean, we had poor Paul Whelan, who suffered for over 6 years. And we've been trying to get him back from the very beginning, and the U.S. government has been working hard to get him and all of them back. So it did take a long, long time to make it happen. And even this particular deal, from everything I'm reading, it looks like serious conversations about this deal began at the beginning of the calendar year. So it's, took a good half of a year to pull it all together.
What do you think finally got it over the finish line?
So it all boiled down to getting Germany to agree to release an individual named Vadim Kosikov, I believe is his name, who was a Russian assassin who went into Germany and shot execution style a Chechen rebel from Chechnya that Russia was not very happy with. He had been convicted of this murder. The Germans were not at all keen on letting this murderer be released. It took several months of conversations at the diplomatic level. The vice president, Harris, got involved. President Biden himself got involved with the German chancellor. And ultimately, they got the German chancellor's concurrence on making it happen. There were a lot of moving parts. I mean, there were 26 people altogether as part of this exchange, and they came from several countries. So, you know, coordinating the release from different allies, different countries, coordinating it all so it could all happen on the same day was quite a complicated task.
Now, what is the role national intelligence plays in developing or informing the United States position in what it's willing to offer, what it's willing to not offer, what it's looking to get back?
Sure. So the this complicated of an exchange involving this many countries, this many different legal issues, this many different issues surrounding intelligence would have definitely been handled in what we call the interagency process that's ultimately led by the president that brings together all the key players. In this case, you would have had players from justice, from the intelligence community, from the State Department, probably from Homeland Security on the U.S. side, getting together to adjudicate the, you know, the pros and the cons of the release of any of these individuals from U.S. or Western custody, and deciding which of the prisoners in Russia that we absolutely wanted or needed to get back. As you know, the prisoners we got back did not just include U.S. people. It included a number of Navalny associates, people associated with the opposition leader Navalny, who died in prison. And so that added another complicating factor. So the role of intelligence, it would have been to inform the process about the various prisoners, what the charges were, what their status was, where they perhaps were located. The intelligence community would have been involved in assessing likelihoods of different governments to release prisoners, what some of those governments might have wanted in exchange. And then lastly, the intelligence community, at least in this instance, got very involved in the direct negotiations. They opened a channel through a Middle Eastern country that remains unnamed, with the Russian intelligence service to coordinate with Russia the terms of the agreement. Oftentimes, particularly with authoritarian regimes that lean very heavily on their intelligence services, not only for intelligence, but for suppression purposes in their country, those countries often look at intel to intel service exchanges and conversations as being the most trusted. And so we will often use our intelligence services to hold those kinds of conversations as well.
Well, with a prisoner swap of this magnitude, how much are the leaders themselves having to have dialogue in this? You know, how much of this is diplomats doing groundwork as well, along with the intelligence community?
So the bulk of the work was done by the great men and women at the State Department, the great men and women of the U.S. intelligence community. But in order to, you know, close some highly sensitive or high priority deals, they needed to get the president involved, the vice president involved, the leaders of some of these other countries to perhaps accelerate a release, to perhaps have a national leader exercise authorities that might not be available to their justice system in a country, you know, some kind of pardoning authority or of that, things of that nature. So a prisoner swap of this magnitude, you know, 26 prisoners from several countries, definitely would have required our president to be involved in making final adjudications about some of these decisions, and perhaps having to, as we now know, weighing in with counterparts. Two critical ones were him weighing in with the German chancellor when he was visiting and getting the agreement from him, and then in the last weeks before the actual exchange occurred, finalizing a deal with Slovenia to get them to release two prisoners that the Russians were very eager to get back as well. And those conversations made it happen. Then once the deal happened, getting back to your original question, once the deal happened, then the job is to make it happen as quickly as possible so that nothing can go wrong and bust up the deal. It appears from some of the press reporting based on inside sources that back in February, we were very close to having the deal finalized, and Navalny dies in prison. And that just froze up all negotiations. It froze the Russians up from having any conversations with us. It kind of put the Germans on a little bit of hesitation as well. And so you wanted to, once you had the deal done, you wanted to move fast to make it, to execute it and make it happen.
Now, just to give some context to your own credentials, because I think it informs the broader conversation here, you know, what does it entail to be director of the White House Situation Room? You know, is there overlap in the conversations involved here? You know, there's interagencies, there's a lot of countries involved. You know, are there similarities in those scenarios?
So the Situation Room is, number one, the place where these meetings of the interagency, the meetings led by the president, the vice president, the national security advisor, would have taken place to discuss this. So the Situation Room, you know, is responsible for making sure that space is available and making sure that the individuals have all the tools and techniques and information they need for those meetings. In addition, the Situation Room has a group of 24-hour watch officers who monitor intelligence activity on a 24/7 basis. And so they are keeping the president and the national security advisor, the vice president, homeland security advisor, and other principals of the White House abreast of any breaking developments. So it's very likely that as this thing was being executed, they were involved in receiving reports from embassies, from reports from the State Department, reports from the CIA that they could relay immediately to Jake Sullivan or President Biden or Vice President Harris as necessary.
Well, when we're looking at this from a national intelligence perspective, you know, how are we determining, or how is the country determining, to put a value or risk on what's being given up? In this case, from the perspective of the United States, what does that look like in this decision-making?
It's a very challenging proposition, the pros and cons of these prisoner exchanges. I mean, obviously, we want these Americans who we deemed as being held under bogus charges and being given ridiculous prison sentences. We wanted these people back, you know, reunited with their loved ones. So that was a very, very high priority. But in the process of doing this exchange, you're giving up, in some cases, Russian intelligence officers or Belarusian intelligence officers back to their countries where they could be rehabilitated and put back into the service. You also had, I believe, some computer hackers, Russian computer hackers that were returned to Russia, who could be then rehabilitated and used by their service to conduct these activities. So that's unfortunate. Now, I will say one slight advantage we have is the Russians historically are famous for not trusting their own people who have been held in U.S. or Western prisons. They immediately assume that they've been turned. They immediately assume that they have been feeding information to the U.S. against Russian interests. And so there may be a significant lack of trust. Now, you will see them parade these Russian prisoners now released on their news, and they'll, you know, you'll see them at the nightclubs having a great time and going out to dinner with their families. But in many instances, we have known that those individuals realistically don't get back involved in intelligence services because they just don't trust their own people after they've been in an American or a German or a, you know, Swedish prison or something. So it's fascinating in that regard. But, you know, you are returning capabilities. You are these individuals, particularly intelligence individuals, that may very well have sat down with the CIA or the FBI and given us information that could be useful. They could then go back and inform the Russian intelligence services what they gave up in a debrief, which would allow the Russians to then develop countermeasures to make sure that, you know, what technique or capability that they may have squealed about is now protected. So there is that risk as well. So those are the things that immediately come to mind.
In Depth will return after a moment.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. MIDI clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. MIDI offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
Now, in regards to these talks, does Russia have any sense of leverage in negotiations like this, where on one hand you have someone like Evan Gerskovich, who isn't a spy, is a journalist, a regular person, and as you mentioned, on the other side you have intelligence officers, hackers, people like that. Do they hold an advantage in the talks? How does that play out?
So I have a number of former colleagues from the intelligence services who, you know, are very concerned about the number of Russian intel officers that we have returned and the fact that we have returned them in exchange for people that were taken, in essence, taken hostage. And some are concerned that this is rewarding the Russians for the bad behavior. And, you know, lo and behold, we saw in the news yesterday, another American has been arrested and thrown in prison over there. So so it is a concern that it's like the old adage, don't negotiate with terrorists because you're just rewarding bad behavior. So there is some concern that we're rewarding bad behavior and they'll just continue it. And when they need to, they'll sweep up some Americans who are in Russia for whatever reason, family relations, business relations, et cetera. I mean, some of these people who are current, I mean, there are still, well, we'll get to that in a moment. The leverage ultimately they have is the fact that we in the West, we in America in particular, hold human life and human liberty and human freedom to a much greater degree than they ever have and ever will. And they know that when they hold somebody that they know they're holding for bogus reasons, particularly high-profile individuals like Evan Gershkovich or the basketball player, Brittany Griner, I think her name, you know, they know the U.S. Those cases get a lot of high profile attention in our press and in our public social media. So they know that builds pressure on the U.S. So that's some of the leverage they gain, by grabbing some of the people they have grabbed.
Now, you alluded to this before. Do we still have prisoners out there for which we're negotiating in Russia or otherwise in other countries? And is there anyone sort of as high profile who's sort of that next one on the list that becomes the focus for the U.S. diplomats?
Well, there are definitely, you know, American prisoners being held around the world in trumped up charges or perhaps being held in conditions that we would consider excessive for the charges that they have been levied against them. I mean, what immediately comes to mind is the issues surrounding recreational marijuana or medicinal marijuana or cannabis or CBD. There are some countries where, you know, CBD is completely banned and you'll go to jail for 20 years if you bring it into the country, where here in the United States, you can, you know, most places in the United States, you can go and get it over the counter. So we definitely have people who, including in Russia, who've been arrested on charges. I think there's a guy named Mark Fogel, who's probably the highest profile guy in Russia still. He was arrested, you know, basically on the same charges that Brittany Griner was held, the WNBA player. He had medicinal marijuana that was prescribed to him for back pain in his luggage that was found, and he's been sentenced to prison and he's still there, and he and his family are not at all happy that he wasn't swept up as part of this exchange. And we have, you know, and then we have the horrible situation of Austin Tice being held by the Syrians, and the U.S. is still very eager to get him freed from Syria at some point. So, but I believe in Russia itself, articles I've read have outlined you know, somewhere between 8 and 10 or 12 people, Russians, or, I mean, I'm sorry, American citizens or American green card holders that are being held. And it's a variety of issues. I mean, in some cases, they're individuals who were arrested because they got in a drunken brawl or they were trafficking drugs. One individual was arrested because he was accused of abusing his children, and his children of a Russian woman who had returned to Russia, having accused him of being abusive. He was arrested by the Russians when he went to try to retrieve his children. He claims that he didn't abuse his children. The Russians say otherwise. So we just have a number of cases like that. We don't have anything quite as dramatic as in Russia as an Evan Gershkovich situation or Paul Whelan situation at the moment. But every one of those people who's held over there who feels they're being unjustly held, the State Department is concerned about them. They're reviewing their cases. And in appropriate cases, they will declare that these individuals as being unjustly held and will then try to get them.
Well, we've mentioned throughout this conversation what a major deal this was, the negotiations and everything that went into this. But just how rare and unique is a scenario like this particular prisoner swap?
It's pretty unique and pretty rare. The last time we had an instance like this was back in 2010 when we had the Russian sleeper agents in our country that we rolled them all up and then returned them to Russia in exchange for some prisoners from Russia. That was probably the most recent similar sized case that gained some notoriety. So it is rare. During the Cold War, probably happened more frequently, because we would have individuals swept up who were conducting reconnaissance, and we would arrest Russians who were doing reconnaissance in Europe or elsewhere, and so there would be periodic exchanges. But since the Cold War, there just have not been that many, and not of the size and magnitude of the one we just witnessed.
Now, on the Russian side of things, we saw the video when their prisoners were landing, and Vladimir Putin greeted some of the children in Spanish because they did not know they were Russian. They didn't know their parents were Russian. They had no idea that they were intelligence agents. I mean, it sounds like the plot of a movie. It's almost unbelievable. But to see things like that, is that out of the ordinary? Is something as sort of outlandish as that normal for these types of people that we're talking about?
So the Russians have a large dedicated program to put people in foreign countries under completely different identities, and in many, many cases as a different nationality. And we saw that back in 2010 with a number of the individuals that were arrested here in America. They were blending into society. They were acting as if they were Americans. I think some of them had children as well. And, children of a certain age are just not informed about their parents' espionage activity, because the last thing you want is little Johnny or little Jane in a playground somewhere starting to talk about their parents being spies for some foreign country. Sadly, these young children grew up believing they were Argentinian and did not know that they were Russian, and I think they even said they didn't even know they were going to Russia until they landed. I think the one story was the little girl asked her mom, "Who was that man that just greeted us so happily on the tarmac?" And she's like, "Oh, that's the president of Russia." Very sad. Very sad. Those children clearly are going to have some psychological issues to deal with over time. There's probably some trust issues as well. But even in the U.S. intelligence community, at CIA, for example, we have a cadre of individuals that are operations officers or human intelligence officers, and they operate undercover overseas. In many cases, they operate as under diplomatic cover. They may be a first secretary or a political counselor or something, but their real job is to go out and collect, meet foreigners and try to get them to give us information that they would otherwise not want to give us from their country. Those individuals, in most cases, do not tell their children until their children reach some age of reason. They do not tell them that they work for the CIA. And, it's legend at CIA, the stories you hear about people, finally telling their children where they work. It often happens on Family Day at CIA, when families are allowed to come in, they set up booths and everybody walks around, goes to the cafeteria, and it's kind of our version of Bring Your Child to Work Day. And it's been fascinating to witness people bringing their children into CIA, teenage children usually, into CIA for the first time, and then look at them and go, this is where I really work. And, you know, in most cases, the kids, you know, their minds are blown. They think it's just wild and fascinating. They're still told, you can't go tell your friends where we work, but we wanted you to know and understand what, you know, mommy and daddy are doing for a living.
That is absolutely fascinating, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real sacrifice that intelligence officers, particularly those who happen to operate undercover, make. And, you know, when you marry into that, you yourself are making sacrifices, and you yourself are conducting service to the benefit of the nation without yourself being an employee of the United States government, and children clearly not having any kind of role in making that decision when they're born. So it's one of the things a lot of people don't think about the service our U.S. intelligence officers are providing and the sacrifices they're making.
Well, throughout this, we have talked a lot about what goes into making a deal like this happen, the negotiations, the weighing of what is traded, the risks. But we've also touched on the very grounded, everyday aspect of this. And you mentioned Brittany Griner. I saw her play in the gold medal game at the Olympics, and she was crying after they had won.
Yeah.
And she has said in interviews that those tears are ones of gratitude to a country that fought to bring her home because she didn't think she would be back. How much does a realization like that, of the importance of bringing Americans back to their families, to their loved ones, play into the minds of everyone who is working on this and making these decisions?
Oh, it absolutely plays into their work. You know, you saw Jake Sullivan, you know, got emotional talking about these deals, you know, National Security Advisor. I mean, everybody involved is clearly there to provide a service to the United States. Paramount in that service is protecting the lives of Americans here and abroad. And, just having that conversation about what Brittany Griner's been saying in her interviews, and I saw some of that on television as well. I actually got some goosebumps sitting here while you were talking about it, because it's wonderful to see them being grateful. I would not at all be upset if any of them were a little upset, particularly if it took a long time to get them out. While they're in prison, I'm sure they're being fed a bunch of lies by their captors about the U.S.'s commitment to helping them. In many cases, they had rare visits from U.S. counselors and very short visits, and often monitored by the Russian prison system or the Russian intelligence services. The guy I was most worried about was Paul Whelan. I thought, you know, here was a man who did not deserve to spend 6 years in hard labor in a Russian prison camp. Another goosebumps moment for me was seeing the President of the United States on the tarmac take his American flag pin off and put it on Paul Whelan as a token of his devotion to how much he had worked to get him free. And I read the other day that Paul Whelan has not taken that flag pin off. Again, another sign of his gratitude, and I'm very grateful to see that.
Larry Pfeiffer, I want to thank you so much for getting into this topic with us and giving us some insight into what played out and what comes next. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
And KCBS's Mike DeWald, thank you for joining me on In Depth this week.
Thank you.
You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. Just go to the podcast tab and look for In Depth. You can also hear In Depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.